So, hi everybody, and welcome to the ABCs of Green Politics. I'm your host for this session, John Barry. The ABCs of Green Politics is part of the Left Bloc with a C political education project that has some other sister podcasts, the Workers' Guide to Everything, The Week at Work, Nun na Nóg, and a new podcast, North, about issues around Northern Ireland and the north of Ireland in the context of arguments for unification. So we've finally got the V. We started off with A in the ABCs about 2 years ago. It's taken us a long time. So we got the V, and today V is not for venereal disease or vicariousness, but V is for violence. And I'm delighted to welcome onto the podcast a good friend, an academic colleague, Dr. Ross Mittiga, who currently is a researcher in the Department of Philosophy at the University of Graz. And Ross has just written a fantastic book that I think we might get into in the podcast, because it relates to some of the themes about violence, a theory of change, what do we do in response to the worsening climate and ecological crisis. And the book is called Climate Change as Political Catastrophe Before Collapse, just published by Oxford University Press. And I'm just going to hand over now and ask Ross to introduce himself, and then we can get into some of the issues in the book, but also talking about, are we reaching a point now, not just for ideological or normative reasons, but purely for scientific or almost functional reasons, we are now at a point that our theory of change in relation to the planetary crisis has to include something that many of us feel quite reticent about discussing, which is the issue of violence, the role of violence, the threat of violence in the context of a theory of change, in the context of our worsening planetary crisis. So, Ross, you're very welcome to the podcast.
Yeah, hey, thank you very much for inviting me on here. I've been listening to a couple of the podcasts recently. I've really enjoyed them, so I'm happy to take part in the conversation. And thank you for the generous introduction. Yeah, so I'm here in Austria at the University of Graz. As you said, before that, I worked for about 5.5 years in Santiago, Chile. And originally, I'm from the U.S., with apologies. and so, yeah, a lot of my work has to do with taking seriously the worst case outcomes of climate change, or taking the kind of more catastrophic scenarios seriously, and trying to figure out what the potential for climate catastrophe means for us politically speaking, as opposed to just say economically speaking or morally speaking. This is a conversation that's already going on in a lot of other disciplines, slowly, but it's been picking up in recent years. But it's a conversation that has really not been had so much in political science or philosophy. So that's what a lot of my work is attempting to do. And the book that you mentioned that just came out last month, that I just finished late last year, focuses squarely on that. Trying to get a sense, a political conception of catastrophe, and trying to explain what the potential of politically catastrophic climate change means for us right now, and what kind of reactions, responses are necessary for confronting that. The work that I'm undertaking now is very much in the theme of this podcast, which is to say, taking seriously the possibility, perhaps the necessity, of undertaking more kind of coercive forms of direct action, we could say, undertaking more, say, potentially violent forms of resistance. What justifies that? What counts as violence? What would legitimate targets be in this kind of situation? What limits apply to these kinds of actions, and so forth? So I'm really happy to be talking to you about this.
No, I mean, I think it's an incredibly intellectually brave move, Ross, in terms of your book and your work, and obviously, you know, we had you here as a visiting fellow at Queen's University Belfast very, very briefly, where you gave some talks about almost saying the quiet part out loud. I mean, at what point do we say fossil fuel capitalism, for example, is a direct threat to the lives and livelihoods of us and our children and others across the planet? And to how longer do we continue to flog or use the dead parrot? If you know the Monty Python sketch, it's almost like liberal reformism is like a dead parrot. We've tried it, you know, it hasn't worked. XOR and Just Stop Oil and other more radical elements of climate movement, they've tried direct action, civil disobedience. And in a way, it might be too soon to say that that hasn't worked. But what do we do? Do we keep going on with these liberal reformist ways of acting? And suppose I'm interested in, you know, I'm not saying for you to lay down, as philosophers are wont to do, particularly analytical philosophers, the specific conditions under which, you know, violence is necessary or legitimate, but maybe give some broad outlines of where you see that story I've narrated. You know, we've had the science for quite some time telling us we're going the wrong direction. We've had unevenly distributed kind of green climate responses of political parties, social movement, trade unions. God bless his cotton socks, you know, Pope Francis and Laudato Si, even the Catholic Church getting behind this. But none of these have, you know, switched the dial in terms of reducing greenhouse gases or creating much more coherent and appropriate science-based climate, you know, strategies. So where do you think are we going? And we, of course, is, you know, in the global south, it might be different than in the global north. But in terms of, are we reaching, not the tipping point that we often think about in climate science, where the earth will just irrevocably, you know, and unalterably switch into a new climate state, that tipping point, but actually a political tipping point where the climate movement, you know, basically loses its temper, as it were, and starts engaging in much more aggressive, including violent types of actions.
Yeah, well, first of all, you know, again, thanks for the very kind words, and I could say very much the same to you. I think, John, a lot of people are inspired by your activism and your work over the years, and I'm certainly among them. Now, in terms of the broader question about how we can start to think more carefully about this, you know, I would say, you know, the philosophical instinct is strong here, and there is a part of me that wants to try to break the question into smaller questions, and I think that's actually useful because this is really a fraught topic and one that we have to treat carefully. Now, I think, you know, an initial question here is the simple one of, you know, what counts as violence? You know, and I'll say this, once we lay out some of these questions, I think then we can get to the deeper, you know, more exigent question here, which is, you know, what role is this going to play in a movement, or what role must it play in the climate movement? But you know, just to get a kind of brief sense here, you know, when we're talking about violence, to make it, I think, a little bit less abstract, you know, most people have in mind, obviously, the idea of physical harm to human others. But of course, when philosophers deal with this, and I think a lot of activists, lay people, certainly in the media and so on, any kind of attack on or destruction of, you know, productive or private property is often construed as violence. I think more controversially, we might think of violence also having it might count as violence to think about impact to ecologies, non-human animals, and so forth. Now, taking that kind of wide view of violence, I think, you know, there's something that Callum said in the R for Revolution podcast, which is, you know, violence cuts both ways. It's not just the violence that a resistance movement might undertake, but it's the violence that we're suffering right now, you know, at the hands of carbon power. So you get this idea then of violence in a general sense, and get this idea that it you know, it's both something that's being inflicted on us, and by us, I mean the vast, overwhelming global majority, and of course, the generations yet to come, and the entirety of non-human nature. Once you have that broad picture of violence, you know, the question is, when is violence justified? That's the first, I think, real conceptual question. And I think clearly there's not a soul in the world that's going to say the violence that's being done to us right now is justified. Although there are always attempts to excuse it, right? You know, the world just needs cheap meat. It just needs fast and ready transport. It just needs, you know, quick and easy energy. Certainly, I think that's how The titans of carbon power, you know, put themselves to sleep at night, is with that refrain of, I'm just supplying the world with, you know, what it's demanding. You know, leaving aside all these obviously complicating questions about, you know, the reality of alternatives, even cost-effective alternatives and so on. So clearly that kind of violence, the violence being done to us, is not justified. So then I guess the relevant, you know, moral question before we get into the politics of this is, you know, would violence resistance be justified? And, you know, again, I do kind of want to answer this as a philosopher, although I think that this is an answer that should make sense to you know, the non-philosophers among us, which is, you know, when we're thinking about would violence resistance be justified, I think there's really two kinds of considerations here. You know, one is, are there people or things or entities that are liable to be harmed, which is to say that have acted in such a way that make them appropriate targets of violent resistance? And two, is violent resistance necessary? Is there a necessity of action here? Now, when we think about liability, and, you know, please cut me off or jump in anytime if I'm talking too loud, too long. I don't want this to be a lecture or a sermon. You know, when we think about liability to be harmed, has anybody or anything made themselves appropriate targets of violent action? No, I would argue clearly the answer is yes. And yes, in what sense? You know, what have they done? What have these entities done to make them, you know, to forfeit their right not to be harmed? Well, I mean, you know, the statistics that we could quote here are, you know, as dreary as they are plentiful. You know, you just type in climate mortality into Google Scholar, or, you know, air pollution deaths. You know, I was reading recently, there was a Lancet report that came out that said globally 5,083,173 deaths were associated with non-optimal temperatures each year between 2000 and 2019. Now, I'm fascinated, right? The specificity of that. Not 5,083,173 deaths. And they say that with a 95% confidence interval, which is, you know, the kind of gold standard in these scientific studies. There's another article by PNAS that found that the fine particulate matter, PM2.5, that comes above all from burning fossil fuels, again, could be linked with a 95% confidence to an additional 8.9 million deaths in the year 2015 alone. There's another study around the same time that suggested 10.2 million deaths occurred because of that fine particulate matter in 2012. Both the World Health Organization and Lancet have published estimates of additional climate-related deaths ranging from 250,000 to 530,000 a year between 2030 and 2050 on the climate modeling scenarios that we have. Now, look, some people might be tempted to say those figures are way overblown. You know, what do these asshole scientists know anyway? Let's just assume that they are off by, you know, an order of magnitude here, that only 10% of those deaths are really going to occur or really have occurred. We're still talking about millions of people a year, millions of people a year. And so to me, that answers pretty clearly the liability question, that there are entities, there are agents, there are processes that are responsible for mass amounts of human death. Now, we haven't even talked about, you know, economic loss. We haven't talked about cultural loss. We haven't talked about, you know, nations being swallowed by the sea. We haven't talked about climate displacement or any of that. We're just talking about pure human mortality, life and death here. So if we take that view seriously, then, you know, we have to ask, well, what would these targets be? Who exactly would be liable? What would be liable to be harmed? What would be liable to violent resistance? You know, and I think there are a few, you know, things that we could consider here. I'm not endorsing any of these. I think most naturally, most obviously, would be, you know, the machinery, the productive property of carbon industries, carbon-intensive industries. But some have also argued or take seriously the idea that, you know, the private property, especially, you know, the especially gauche private property like yachts and private jets and so on of carbon industry leaders and those complicit in their crimes, you know, that kind of tainted wealth, the expressions of gross wealth accumulated by these carbon industry insiders, you know, that might be a legitimate target. You know, some have argued, or at least have fictionalized accounts in which even those people themselves would be legitimate targets. Now, I think before we get our pitchforks out, we also have to think about the second factor, which is the necessity of harming. And I got thoughts about that too. I don't know if you want to jump in here, but I think this is an important point also.
No, that means that's an excellent kind of overview, Ross, of the fact that the kind of structural violence of the current carbon order is already causing the, you could say, needless deaths of millions of people. These are equivalent in a way to like sacrifice zones that we're kind of familiar with in terms of environmental justice, in terms of fracking or, you know, the extraction of rare earth metals and under horrendous conditions in Africa. Well, now we have sacrificed people. It's almost similar to arguments I often have with my own students about our car-based mobility in societies like Britain, Ireland, and America results in thousands and thousands of people being killed and injured every year. And it's almost like, well, that's the, you know, the cost of car-based mobility. And that's almost like the kind of argument you're outlining for people to say, well, this is the cost that we have to pay for a carbon base. Look at all this great stuff that carbon has produced. And just as, Vicky, for those listening, when you were referring to these kind of fictionalized accounts, I think you might have in mind something like Kim Stanley Robinson's Ministry for the Future. So for people listening, if you haven't read it, do yourself a favor, particularly in terms of this podcast and the themes we're discussing. In that, you know, to me, it was an extraordinary book that I read. It was very academically grounded, you know, scientifically literate. It had everything from the latest climate science, geoengineering, even modern monetary theory and so on in there. But just to underscore what Ross was saying here is that in that fictional, folks, if any of the state security services are listening, we are talking about a fictional novel called The Ministry for the Future. And it's kind of loosely based on kind of Mary Robinson character, where it's an Irish diplomat who's given charge of this new ministry to protect the world in terms of climate and ecological disaster. But anyway, to cut to the chase, there is a terrible heat wave in India that causes the deaths of, I don't know, was a million people or hundreds of thousands of people. And out of that then begins a resistance movement called the Children of Kali, who start basically taking out billionaires out of the sky on their private jets and so on. Now, that's the fiction. We're not suggesting any of that in reality here, folks. But you could say there's an echo of it in how Extinction Rebellion in places like Germany and the Netherlands are now going on to airfields, some of them private airfields, and gluing themselves or somehow preventing, you know, private jets from taking off as these kind of egregious, you know, almost forms of conspicuous consumption that is causing these harms. I suppose the question probably that Ross to consider is that enable you to go on to probably the next stage of your argument in terms of, you know, there is a harm that we can demonstrably and scientifically prove that's happening. The fact that maybe there's a lot of brown and black and yellow people, is that the issue? That there's a kind of a racism underlying this, that not enough white people are being killed? And that's what makes it interesting to compare the deaths under COVID as opposed to what's happening now in the climate crisis. We, you know, had a public health emergency because a lot of white people were dying. And we had the mobilization of the resources of the state to prevent that, whereas we don't see the same in terms of the climate crisis. So I'm wondering, against all of that background, you know, if you're advising the climate movement, as in part, I think, you know, although you're a rigorous analytical philosopher, you're just outlining the arguments. I think also there's a conversation you're at least having, maybe sotto voce, maybe with the climate movement. You know, what is your advice to them in the context of, again, the worsening climate crisis that we you know, you've outlined and I've kind of just added to?
Yeah, I mean, there's a lot here to respond to. You know, I think, you know, first of all, thanks for mentioning the Kim Stanley Robinson's book. I read that about the same time that I read Andreas Malm's How to Blow Up a Pipeline, and those two books, you know, they really blow your hair back. Reading them together, I think, is especially valuable. And I think there's a lot there in terms of you know, sussing out a politically plausible theory of change. Now, you know, I think it's I don't know how well suited I am to be, you know, a counselor to the climate movement. You know, a lot of times I feel like what I'm doing is just drawing inspiration from what they're doing and trying to, you know, I don't know, almost play a kind of John Locke role of justifying the rebellion, seeking out intellectual arguments for making sense of how these things are going. But I would say this, and I think this does relate to the second consideration that I think that we really have to take seriously when we're countenancing, or when you know, those out there are countenancing violent forms of resistance, or even more extreme radical forms of activism, which is that necessity consideration. And here, what I have in mind is not just whether or not more radical forms of resistance are necessary, which I think clearly they are. And the evidence of that is, you know, 30 years of inaction, a lifetime of carbon accumulation, an acceleration into the climate problem, you know, rather than any kind of meaningful response to get us out of that. What I have in mind when I'm talking about necessity is a reflection over what reasons we have for undertaking radical resistance. You know, what's the purpose or the end of our resistance in the climate movement? You know, and I think when we take that seriously, we're probably going to get away from, you know, as I think people even in Kim Stanley Robinson's book eventually do, spoiler alert, from, you know, from an obsessive focus on individuals, perhaps too heavy a focus on their own private property. I think, you know, the real targets, the necessary targets, are going to be those that are the most immediate mechanisms of harm. You know, the real weapons of mass destruction in our world, which is to say the productive property of carbon power. And that means pipelines, oil refineries, tankers, coal trains, dirty power plants, maybe industrial animal farms. And you know, in what sense are those the necessary targets? Well, again here, what's the purpose or the end of resistance, of violent resistance, of, you know, radical resistance, you know, call it what you may. Certainly, I don't think it can be the punishment of wrongdoers. Resistance is different than retribution. But I do think there are two aims that have to be pursued here, or that will be pursued. Again, I'm not trying to play counter to the movement so much as, you know, trying to give a little bit of a sense of how I understand the shape of the movement. And I think that there are two basic broad sets of aims. We might call one the kind of aims of rebellion, the other the aims of revolution. One, the aims of rebellion, I see this playing out more in the short term, and this maybe is the kind of more immediate motivation for strong forms of activism. And you know, I was trying to think as I was preparing for this this discussion with you, John, about how can I explain what I have in mind by the aims of rebellion. And I think there's a kind of mantra here, which is, you know, the aims of rebellion are to get those responsible to bleed green and to feel yellow. You know, by bleed green, I have in mind that, you know, the capitalist class, they think in dollars and cents and euros, you know, be it what it may, in cost and short-term risks. And so part of the idea of, I'm going to call it strong climate activism, must be to make them lose money, to make it impossible to insure their property, to make it difficult or impossible to get loans from banks, to bleed their bank accounts. And by feel yellow, I haven't, you know, have in mind the idea, you know, to make those responsible for these climate harms, to be a little bit afraid of what they're doing. You know, not just because they're losing money, but because of the shame that will come with this, the notoriety. Now here, you know, perhaps, you know, depending on how we think about necessity and so on, about the importance of this feel yellow aim of rebellion, you know, this is where maybe going after some of the most conspicuous forms of you know, carbon intensive consumption might be targeted, like yachts and private jets and, you know, third homes and that kind of thing. So that's what I call the aims of rebellion. The you know, make them bleed green and feel yellow. But I think in addition to that, I think we have to take seriously this idea of the aims of revolution. This has to be another element in the necessity calculus. And what I have in mind here is that deeper sense in which, you know, the climate movement might help to undermine the foundations of carbon power. Now, my inspiration here is thinking about how Europe, as opposed to, say, the United States, became a lot more progressive, a lot more worker-friendly in the aftermath of World War II. You know, maybe you know about this, John. You know, what's the relevant theory here? Well, the relevant theory is that, you know, during the war, all these countries bombed the shit out of each other, but especially the factories. They especially attacked industrial power, which meant that the owners of industrial capital were, you know, reduced to the level of the working class. That created a rare historical moment in which, you know, the political power of the ownership class was not as greatly exaggerated as it normally is with respect to the working classes. And so real progress could be made. You know, I think the aims of revolution here should be, in some sense, to reduce the power of the carbon capitalist class. You know, so it's not just about stopping harm, but reordering, you know, the political strata of society in some ways. I certainly think those are both elements in the necessity calculus here.
I really like the way you phrase that in terms of rebellion. Of course, we have Extinction Rebellion and civil disobedience is kind of in that category. Revolution is often removed from our thinking because, oh, it's the Bolshevik Revolution, it's violence, it's chaos, and so on. And one way, just listening to you there, Ross, is that almost like rebellion is about harm reduction. It's about, you know, trying to prevent the immediacy of harm, to reduce vulnerability, you know, and the destruction of lives and livelihoods in the here and now, whereas revolution is about dealing with the causes. So one is dealing with the effects, the negative effects, which you've already documented in terms of the number of people dying and whose lives are blighted because of carbon capitalism. But revolution is about, well, the structural issues underpinning that. Why is it these are being caused? It's a bit like the way in which it drives me to distraction, and it may do you or others listening, the way in which many in the Western media in covering the genocide in Gaza talk about Palestinians dying. And you kind of say, what, they're just spontaneously dropping dead, that there's no agency involved in it. And it's, you know, it's another part, that another discussion that we can have in another day. But it's about naming the harm producers and those being harmed, and then seeing, okay, our immediate reaction as most right thinking, you know, decent people is let's reduce the harm. So you attend to the immediate needs of people. I get that. It's almost akin like to charity. You know, we have to deal with the immediate need in front of us. But actually what you need to do is say, well, what's causing the harm? It's a bit like, you know, as you would know from your experience in Latin America, and I'm overly fond of stating this, even though I'm a completely collapsed Catholic, but the liberation, you know, theologian, Dom Helder Camara in Brazil, you know, when I give food to the poor, they call me a saint. When they ask where the poor have no food, they call me a communist. And it seems to me what you're doing is both attending to the immediate harm that's happening as a result of climate capitalism, but then saying it's not enough just to deal with the immediate harm reduction. I really like that idea, bleed green, you know, and, you know, feel yellow. I think, you know, making people feel ashamed. And of course, we have a tradition, which, you know, I know you're aware of as well, given that you're interested in certainly Irish politics in the 19th and 20th century, of things like boycotting, you know, that where we shame that, you know, in the same way that people, I think, feel ashamed, or at least are the social norm now, you don't smoke in, you know, in private, you don't smoke in pubs. Similar to the argument I used to make 20 years ago, when somebody used to ask me, oh, do you mind if I smoke, John? And I'd say, oh, no, do you mind if I piss in your shoe? It's kind of, you know, it's that kind of equivalent in terms of social norms have now shifted, where people are self-regulating their behavior, hopefully in the interest of the greater good in a way. So I really like that that particular framing. But one question I wanted to, you know, feel free to come back on what I've said there, Ross, as well. But I've noticed in your book that you've skillfully developed Rosa Luxemburg's view. She used to have that view, socialism or barbarism. Then you had Istvan Meserios in the 70s, a very eminent Marxist scholar who said basically barbarism if we're lucky. That was his analysis. And I noticed that you've had, or there's a chapter, I think, in your book called Environmentalism or Barbarism. So I wonder, you know, do you want to talk about, you know, that sense, particularly, you know, the question I'm getting at is the issue of hope, that actually agency and possibilities of change, which is partly, if you have the time tied up, it's something we were talking about before we went on air, is almost like the moral failure of intellectuals, the people in our profession, in terms of they don't really believe that change is possible, therefore they're not invested in it, therefore they feel threatened by maybe our conversation or your book or some of the work that we have produced. So that idea of hope, and particularly, you know, the role of intellectual workers like ourselves in this, you know, you kind of say, what the hell is going on in the academy? Are these supposed smart people with access to the scientific evidence that you and I would have, and you've outlined it, why aren't they as shit scared as you are, am I? Why aren't they, you know, talking about these really difficult but important issues in terms of how do we change society in the direction of, as you say, of revolution?
Yeah, so many great questions there, John. I'm not sure if I'll be able to do any of them really justice. You know, there are a few things I could say kind of speculatively here. You know, the first, you know, with respect to the I think the really important question of what grounds for hope do we have? You know, as anybody who has been involved in climate activism will know, you're always going to have people around you presenting you with the ever-paling question of, like, what does it matter what you're doing? You know, you try to fly less, they'll say, what does it matter? You try to eat vegan, they'll say, what does it matter? You're one person. You show up to a climate protest, you risk arrest, they'll say, why do you risk arrest? I think the same kind of question, of course, gets put to academics. And, you know, academics, ever the intellectual sort, you know, are want to, you know, we have the time maybe and to think about that too much. It can really, really enfeeble any kind of action. It really, there's a real threat there to taking seriously your own insignificance. But of course, you know, things are always impossible to change until they're not. You know, there's always that moment, right? You know, 70 years ago, half the world, 2/3 of the world was under colonial domination, and then it wasn't. I mean, not to say that all problems have been solved, but a radical change happened. You know, 40 years ago, there was a pretty violent form of authoritarianism that dominated Eastern Europe until just all at once it didn't. You know, there's a great Bertolt Brecht poem that I like that, you know, says, never say never, in this sense that, like, there's always that possibility for radical change. And the evidence is that radical change has happened time and again, precisely when people said it was never going to. So there's that factual element of hope. But I think it also helps us to remember here two things. One, there are massive forces that are bent on distracting us, from debilitating us, on making us feel our own insignificance, on making us feel powerless, precisely so that we don't react. You know, two, what are the alternatives here? What, you know, clearly, our governments are not going to save us. They've at least, you know, of governments of all, you know, professed ideological variations in the liberal world and the non-liberal world have really failed to take action seriously. There's been some changes, little, you know, polite little changes, more recycling centers, more Toyota Priuses. But there's not been that kind of radical change that scientists have been insisting for decades now is necessary. You know, the IPCC, ever conservative, says nothing short of unprecedented change in all sectors of society can deliver us from climate catastrophe. So where's that? They're not going to save us. So that means it falls on us. And the alternatives to not acting here are what? Like the devastation of all that we love, the devastation of our only world, you know, the complete impoverishment and abject suffering of generations to come, the potential of complete civilizational collapse, you know, the loss of all other of the, you know, the millions, myriad beautiful species that exist on this earth. It's too much to contemplate. And that itself can feel overwhelming. But what alternatives do we have to action at this point? And, you know, I think when you take that seriously, and you take seriously, again, the idea that radical change has happened many times in the past, you start to maybe feel a sense that, like, well, maybe I can contribute to this. You know, after all, nobody gets elected by one vote. They get elected by a multitude of votes. No change happens until many people participate in these same activities together. So here, I think, suggests something important. One, you know, not only should we, you know, buy into the myth of our own powerlessness and the impossibility of change, but two, we need to invest in the kind of solidarity networks that are necessary to realize that change. We need to believe in each other and organize and get out there and do that action. And any action is better than no action at all, right? So I think there's that. Now, you know, as to why change has not occurred as quickly as it maybe should, again, you know, we can't underestimate the power of misinformation, disinformation campaigns that have been undertaken at great expense by the fossil fuel industries over the last several decades that are now well documented. You know, we should not overlook the fact that our politicians have been often paid, bribed, that's to say, to look the other way, to empower exactly those actors who are out there to harm us. Basically, we should not forget the power of the carbon industry, but we should also remember that that's an industry that does not fundamentally believe in what it's doing. It believes in its own paychecks. People that are motivated purely by their own paychecks, who captain armies of people who are essentially mercenaries, who probably don't have any special love of what they're doing, those people can be defeated by well-organized, motivated resistance. And so I think that's the next step, really. You know, recognizing that no one else is going to save us, recognizing that we are not powerless, and getting out there and starting to do something about it.
We are the people we've been waiting for, is often a way I end particularly public talks. And just on that, because we're kind of getting into, you know, hope clearly in your analysis, and I completely share that analysis, comes from agency. You know, you have to actively do something, as you say, roll up your sleeves and get involved. And certainly for me, you know, it's an old social movement. I'm talking about the trade union movement. And I don't know whether you have any particular thoughts of the role of organized labor via the trade union movement has in your theory of change in terms of this hopeful agency to act as part of the resistance, or whether you think that we should look for agency somewhere else, maybe, and not just the trade union movement.
Yeah, it's a great question. That's a great question. You know, where do these networks of power exist? Where can they be formed and developed, reoriented, repurposed, complemented, and so forth? You know, I'm a big believer in an all of the above strategy. So, you know, I will never cast aside electoral politics. I'll never cast aside, you know, taking seriously networks of people that already exist. You know, organizing, you know, oftentimes is most effective when it's not from zero, but when you build up what already exists around you. But I think we always also have to be careful not to get captured in the kind of Procrustean, reified structures that maybe are not moving or have not moved as quickly as they can or should. I would say for those motivated who are already involved or invested in labor union networks, it comes down to you to try to take control of those networks. So, you know, I, as I just said, I don't believe in giving up on electoral politics, but that does not mean waiting for a figure to come along who's going to save us. That means you go out there, you primary your local person, no matter, you know, what position, you know, if they say they're the, you know, the leftist, most environmentally friendly person out there, unless they have that record, go after them. Try to get the power. You know, if you're involved in labor networks or community organizing networks or be it what it, you know, whatever it may be, if you don't feel like they're making that kind of action that's necessary, try to seek control of those organizations yourself and push them to those ends, or support the people who you see actively working toward that end. So I think a lot of times here, there's a sense in which we just have to, you know, there's a real belief that maybe, again, somebody's going to come along and save us. But as you rightly said, John, we're the people that we've been waiting for. And nobody is going to give you permission to take power. But it's precisely that we need to start focusing our efforts on. The moral arguments are clear. What we got to sort out now are the political strategies that are necessary for moving society and our states in those directions that we want them to go.
I think that's a great place to end, Ross, in terms of, you know, I'm fairly well known for my throwaway one-liners, and one comes to me just now, which is that it's easier to ask for forgiveness than permission. And I think certainly in the bourgeois liberal democracies where you and I were born and are living, there's been far too much of a complacency or a sense that almost a false belief that the system itself will right itself at some point. Yeah, it'll be, you know, a bit rocky and so on. Whereas actually, what if we're not actually just coming to the end of carbon, or we're actually not just coming to the end of capitalism, we're actually coming to the end of the usefulness of liberal democracy itself, in a way. And that's a pretty, well, scary, but also exciting thought in terms of, you know, these systems we've been talking about. I mean, carbon capitalism, you know, let's be generous, maybe 150 years old, you know, we can give it a good, you know, neoliberalism, you know, 50 years old. Liberal democracy itself in this current form, you know, less than 100 years old. So why on earth do we think that these systems have to continue on forever? And I think that sense that you bring, Ross, which is in a way an implicit element of your analysis, which I think every, you know, thinker or activist in dealing with the planetary crisis needs to take account of. Yes, we're very much future orientated. But actually, we should also look back historically and say, well, where have we come from? And particularly that point you've made. I mean, look at the radical changes that have happened in the past. And from that, actually, should come some hope and a sense of agency. So listen, Ross, it's been absolutely a pleasure chatting to you. I wish you all the best with your research and, you know, the success of your book. But maybe just as a last, you know, question to ask you, you know, what's next for you in terms of your research, or where are you going to move on from your current, you know, book that you just had published?
Yeah, thanks. Well, it's been really delightful speaking to you, even about so heavy a topic in a certain sense. But you know, I say heavy a topic, I do believe there's a lot of grounds for hope here too. And I think taking seriously this idea of radical resistance or violent resistance or whatever suggests that, you know, we still do have some power in this fight, and there's still a fight to come. And I'm wholly convinced that, you know, we do live in a kind of 1848 moment, which is to say at the cusp of probably fairly significant revolutions, not just political ones, but social, spiritual, ecological, and so on. Now, in terms of the work that I have planned ahead, well, I have a number of projects that I'm pursuing right now, but I think most significantly, I have a new book idea that I'm just starting to sketch, which I you know, shared a very 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 early version of with you all in Belfast the end of 2022, which takes seriously this idea. Made this analogy made by many people that climate change confronts us as a kind of war. And I think when you take that idea seriously, you know, the real questions start to become, you know, who's responsible for this war? Who, you know, what can we do in response to the war that's being inflicted upon us? What would winning that war look like? And what kind of constraints do we have to adhere to, both morally and prudentially, as we start to fight back? So that's where I see my research going, at least in the next couple of years. Yeah, and so I would say to anybody who's listening to this, if you're ever interested in talking about these issues, please shoot me an email. I'm always around and happy to discuss these, because I see them as having a more than abstract significance. Yeah.
Well, and of course, W comes after V. So it might be that we get you back on, Ross, maybe with another guest to talk about war, because it's certainly, just to maybe anticipate, and I'm in my head, I'm thinking, yes, we should do W in terms of war, because I've been inordinately fond of using wartime mobilization as the framing of what we're looking at, and saying, well, how did the productive capacities of America and Britain during the last war, they were all aimed at one aim. Well, why don't we have the same purpose of our productive assets in the context of the planetary crisis and lifting our people out of poverty and so on. So that's a great idea, Ross, for, you know, perhaps, you know, having our next conversation to include you and perhaps others. But it's been a pleasure. You've been listening to the, you know, the ABCs of Green Politics, part of the Left Bloc Political Education Project. Do check us out on Patreon and our web pages. And we'll see you down the road, or as my good comrade Stefano Nulon says, we'll see you in the trenches or the victory parade. Take care, everybody.
Thanks a lot, John.